welcome to a brand new season on Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
We've got some very interesting feedback from schools that have chosen not to use textbooks. And schools that choose not to use textbooks, and there are some really interesting case studies of schools that have just decided we don't need textbooks. They have never reported the curriculum as being overcrowded.
I'll bring you the first of a two-part interview with Dr. Anne Looney, the Chief Executive of the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. But first, we go to Barry Hennessy, who has been looking at this week's education news. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. Well, it is indeed good to be back and heading into what will almost certainly be a year of unique challenges for all those who work in the education area. Before the summer, Education Minister Rory Quinn lost no time in setting out his ideological and policy vision for his tenure in Marlborough Street. Within weeks, we'll begin to get a much clearer picture of the financial and staffing resources that'll be available in carrying out some of the most ambitious reforms in schools for many years. Let's maybe take a look at our starting position. We now have a national plan for literacy and numeracy that's intended to inform all aspects of the curriculum at both primary and post-primary level. When primary schools return this week, they must devote an extra 50 minutes a day to literacy and 30 minutes a day to numeracy right up the school. Non-core aspects of the curriculum will have to be sacrificed or at the very least modified in order to ensure that the additional time for literacy and numeracy is delivered in full. Post-primary schools too will have to adopt the literacy and numeracy plan on a whole school basis. The government seems determined to push ahead with curricular reform at post-primary level as well, with press reports this week indicating that the revised junior cycle curriculum will be introduced as early as next year and examined for the first time in 2015. The junior cert exam is to be limited to 8 subjects per student, and it's understood that 50% of the final mark will be awarded for a portfolio of learning completed by the student in class, assessed by class teachers and monitored by the State Exams Commission. The timetable seems incredibly ambitious given that the teaching unions remain opposed to any move away from external assessment in the state exams. The other big question, of course, is what subjects will become optional. A letter-writing lobby of teachers, academics and professionals people emerged over the summer to oppose any downgrading of geography in junior cycle. As we reported on this programme before the break, the Department of Education appears to be wavering on the central role of modern languages in the curriculum. The business lobby has sounded the alarm on that one. So what could take the hits? Business studies, CSPE, the new exam in religion? Don't expect interested parties to roll over quietly on any of those subjects. All the while in the background, Minister Quinn tells us the country is in receivership and we're going to have to do more with less. Now, he got a few months out of that refrain until one highly emotive issue brought parents onto the streets. The number of SNAs in Irish schools is now capped at about 10,500. As teachers return to school, they're discovering that one or two SNAs have not returned. Some children whom teachers regard as highly dependent now only have an SNA for part of the day. Principals are still waiting for the remaining 10% of their resource allocation, which was withheld before the summer. At post-primary, some students who need resource or learning support will start the year waiting for it until teachers' timetables can be completed. And then there's the fear of a further increase in the pupil-teacher ratio, a raising of the age for starting primary school, and the abolition of transition year. All of which leads to a vital observation. However well Rory Quinn presents his vision and mission, there's a real sense of suspicion among teachers that he must address. This week I met a special needs teacher in one Dublin school who expressed the fear that a hidden agenda in the literacy and numeracy strategy involves getting mainstream teachers to do the work currently done in resource periods. If that can be achieved, then you could wield the axe on the resource allocation. If you reduce the number of junior cert subjects each pupil takes or downgrade the place of certain subjects in the curriculum, won't more non-permanent teachers lose their jobs? We're embarking on a period of major change and Minister Quinn faces a tough task if he's to avoid significant conflict with some of the education partners. At third level, the issue of an increase in the registration fee or even a return to fees proper is still a live one, but away from money matters, university administrators have this week been confronting the issue of HPAT and its failure so far to bring down the CAO points requirement for undergraduate entry to medicine and select candidates with a better aptitude for the medical profession. HPAT was introduced introduced in 2009 to measure a range of interpersonal and problem-solving skills deemed relevant among medical professionals. Students who score highly on the test will require fewer CAO points to study medicine at university. However, the combined points total for all participating universities has risen over the past three summers, giving rise to real concerns that candidates who resit the tests or take grinds offered by a number of private schools can increase their scores. And this week, the Provost of Trinity College, Paddy Prendergast, said there was disquiet in his university that HPAT wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. A review of the test is due this autumn, and we'll hopefully get back and tell you what it reveals. And finally, there is the question of the cost of education, particularly at this time of year. Barnardo's estimates that it costs about €800 to send a secondary student back to school and €350 for a primary student. On this week's Inside Education, Anne Looney, the head of the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, refers to the totally unregulated nature of the market for school textbooks in Ireland and how unusual this situation is in the international context. The Irish Educational Publishers Association recently signed up to a voluntary code of practice, promising not to revise any edition of a book within 4 years of its publication. The publishers have also promised to assist schools in operating book rental schemes. But Inside Education understands that Minister Rory Quinn will seek further concessions from publishers with a view to reducing the back-to-school pressure on parents, with an announcement expected as early as this week. It'll be a busy year. It's good to be back, Sean.
Thank you indeed for that, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will, of course, be back at the same time next week. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. You can text the programme on 086 8962 665. Anytime we have a crisis involving young people in this country, calls are made on schools to respond. We've long been hearing about the need for schools to do more in the areas of maths and science, and more recently, literacy. Over the last few months, I've heard calls for schools to provide financial education and driving lessons for students. With such a wide range of interest groups demanding a say in the school curriculum, the body that advises the Minister for Education on the content of our curriculum is therefore one of the most influential educational bodies in the country. It is the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, or the NCCA. During the week, I spoke to the Chief Executive of the NCCA, Dr. Anne Looney, and today I bring you the first part of that interview. A native of Dublin, Anne Looney is a former post-primary teacher of religious education and English. She has been on the full-time staff of the NCCA since 1997, and she has been the CEO since 2001. She holds a doctorate in education from the Institute of Education of the University of London. When I met with Anne Looney, I began by asking her to outline the role of the NCCA.
In technical terms, Sean, the role of the NCCA is to advise the Minister for Education and Skills on curriculum and assessment for early childhood, primary and post-primary education. That's the official one. I think sometimes when we're working with students in schools and they say, what exactly do you do? We always just say, well, you know all the stuff that you have to do in school? Well, we decide what that stuff is. So, and we also decide the learning for early childhood education. So that's pretty much what we do. The NCCA was established and set up as an organisation where all the various partners in education will be represented. And so we have a 25-member board that includes all of the teacher unions, it includes parents, it includes management bodies, higher education interests, business interests. So it's quite a deliberative space. You've got all the stakeholders there on the board. And I suppose in that sense, it means that the advice that we generate to the minister is not simply a whisper in his ear. It's actually quite a well-informed, well-considered well thought through position that has the support of the people around the table.
If you are the ones then who decide the stuff that students have to learn in school, obviously it's very important that you communicate well with the teachers who are going to be delivering the stuff. How do you actually communicate with teachers?
Okay, we have a couple of ways of doing that. And how do teachers communicate with us? Because it's also very important that we hear from classrooms. Until a few years ago, Sean, we had the way we did our work was that we had quite a lot of committees, and we still do, and they're a very important part of the NCCA's work. So if you let's say there's a lot of work going on at the moment on language and literacy in primary education, and mathematics. They're two areas. So both of those would have specialist committees made up of teachers from classrooms, union representative, parents, management bodies. They'd all be around the table. And we would also call on experts with particular expertise in the area. So they would do some of the work. So that's a communication space as well. But we also work directly with schools. And that means that we've networks of schools around the country. Big, if you look at primary schools, we've got two teacher schools and 22 teacher schools. So we've got them all in there. And they're also thinking about and working with us on language in the curriculum. So we've got kind of the expert committee view. We've got the teacher in the classroom view. And they don't always match. Because on one level, you've got somebody who maybe perhaps is a representative or a researcher. But actually, you also need the story from the coalface. So we've got both. And then, of course, we've got something very important, which is our website, which my staff would absolutely massacre me if I didn't mention several times in the course of this interview. But www.ncca.ie is a very popular website with especially primary school teachers, because we've got this really good curriculum planning tool there where you can kind of do all your searching for your strands and strand units. And we would also use that as a means of telling teachers what's going on. But also, we also use it as a way of showing what the schools in our networks are working on. So if you're a teacher and you're saying, I wonder what they're doing on NCCA about this new language curriculum, then you have a look at our website. You can read about it, but you can also watch videos of teachers in classrooms thinking about and working with students on language. And they're really popular, and a lot of teachers look at them on a Sunday evening. That's the most popular night on our website. So I like to think that around about 9 o'clock, after people have watched the news headlines and they're saying, what will I do tomorrow? They think, I'll have a look at the NCCA website and see if I can get some ideas. We have a newsletter. A lot of teachers signed up to that, info@NCCA. Again, you can sign up on our website. But then when it comes to when our advice moves, if you like, from the what will we do thinking about it to the minister and the department deciding this is what we will do, then the department takes over, it issues the primary school curriculum, it sticks the harp on it, it becomes the official curriculum, and then there would be more engagement through the PDST, for example, working with schools. So that's kind of how the circle works.
Do you see it as your role at all to communicate with parents and to listen to parents?
The National Parents Council Primary and the National Parents Council Post-Primary are both represented on my council, and they sit on a number of NCCA committees, and we would also work with their regional clusters. So we'll often find that we get invited out to regional meetings where NPC reps are there. So that's always interesting to meet the local parent representatives and to talk to them about our vision for the curriculum and their experience of it in their own schools, because we can find that we might go out, let's say, to a group of parents in Roscommon, Leitrim, right? And they're, you know, we want to talk to them about the new language curriculum. But their real concern, the way in which they encounter the curriculum, is probably through reading schemes and textbooks and worksheets. So we have really interesting debates with parents about what happens when the vision of the curriculum actually translates to the classroom and they're left with the homework and all the work that has to be done. And we also, in our school networks, especially at post-primary level, when we're working with post-primary schools, we will often work with the parents' associations there as well. So you get parents, local groups of parents who are interested in what's happening in school. So we have quite a lot of engagement with parents, and it's always interesting to get the parent perspective.
In designing the curriculum then, it seems to be a very collaborative and democratic process, a lot of different people involved and communication and so on. To what extent do you think that the curriculum being delivered in school is the curriculum that is written in your various statements of the curriculum at primary and secondary and post-primary level?
There's a big box with the curriculum in it for primary schools, taking primary school as an example. It's a big grey plastic box. Any teacher listening will know. They may have lost the box or are using it for something else, but there's a big set of books, right? And it's really tempting to look at it and go, that's the curriculum, right? But actually, the curriculum is what happens for children in classrooms. And to make the journey from the box of books to that experience, you require the highly skilled professional teacher. The teacher is the key in how the child encounters the curriculum. We tend to, I hate the phrase, and my colleagues here will tell me that I banned it, right? But I really hate the phrase delivering the curriculum, because you kind of have this vision of a poor child and all these books and them kind of being just beaten over the head with all these books. It's not a passive process. The professional educator has a key role in shaping the curriculum and making judgment calls as to when a child is ready to learn, or what's appropriate for a class to do, what, you know, and when they should do it. So the idea that they're slavishly following a curriculum is completely at odds with the idea that when it snows, a teacher is going to do something about snow in a school, or when the class pet gives birth to other pets, whatever it might be, there isn't going to be a discussion about looking after babies and small things. So, or world events, or I think of my own nieces and nephews who became experts in Barack Obama during his visit to Ireland, and Tipperary and Moneygall. There's nothing in the curriculum that says, with all due respect to people from Moneygall, that you need to know about, you know, how Barack Obama came from Moneygall. But there is a curriculum objective that talks about understanding ancestry and where your ancestors came from. And really clever teachers said this is a really good chance to teach that, but to make the judgment of what to do that. I'm just taking that as one example. But you often forget that the teacher's role is absolutely critical in how the children encounter the curriculum. Post-primary level, you can have the same thing. You can have the same syllabus, the same examination, and two geography lessons. And one geography lesson, the students are having the time of their lives. They're engaged, they're active, they're using all the equipment, they're really enthusiastic. And right next door, you've got this, another 30 kids with a big textbook and a blackboard, and they are really not enjoying geography. So the teacher is critical.
So how then would you characterise what's in this grey box? Like, is it a menu of ideas that teachers can draw on, or is it more than that?
I think it has to be more than that, because it's also the set of expectations we have for all learners of particular ages. And there's kind of, it's very important from an equality perspective that we have set down, if you like, what we expect children to learn at each stage of education. I think that's very important. I've heard there's a great definition of curriculum that says it's the set of stories that one generation chooses to tell the next, you know, so it's not a bad definition. And there are actually some things that we want all children to be able to do. We give teachers and schools some choice about how they get to that end point, but the end points are pretty specified. Critics of our curriculum would say maybe they need to be specified a bit more clearly, and we're doing a bit of work on that now, especially around the area of language and literacy.
And for teachers, say, who may be teaching a bit longer and who would have grown up teaching the 1971 curriculum, how do you ensure that they can make the transition to teaching the 99 curriculum at primary school level, for example, or also there have been reforms in post-primary? How do you communicate to ensure that the intended curriculum and the intended outcomes that you would like to see achieved are achieved?
I think that's the role of professional development, and there are, you know, people like the PDST and others, and the PCSP, the Primary Curriculum Support Programme, who kind of went out and helped teachers get to grips with the new curriculum. But the evidence from the primary school curriculum is good, that those teachers who were working with the 71 curriculum, they had already bought into the concept of child-centredness. They'd already bought into active learning. So we were just building on that in the 99 curriculum. But the evidence is that for the most part, teachers have really bought into it. They're very, you know, they're while they think there's a lot there, and there is a lot there, and there's maybe too much there, while they'd like a bit more clarity, the evidence is that they have bought into it, they have made the change. At post-primary level, when there are changes equally, it's about professional development and helping people to get around whatever it might be, new content, new pedagogy, new assessment methods, and that's the job of professional development.
One of the criticisms of the 1999 primary school curriculum is that it's a very broad curriculum. How do you respond to that criticism?
So being a broad curriculum is a criticism. Does that mean that being a narrow curriculum is a good, is something, you know, is a good thing? What's the problem with it being broad?
I think the problem is that teachers find there is so much to do that they are just kind of doing small amounts of different subjects, and that they're finding it hard to reach on achieving all the outcomes that were intended.
I think what you mean then is it does it lead to what they've called drive-by teaching? You know, I'm just going to do 10 minutes of this and 10 minutes of that because I've got to fit it all in.
To cover the curriculum.
To cover the curriculum, exactly. So, and it's the same issue at post-primary level. So we look at if teachers look at the curriculum and they see strands and strand units, and there is some repetition and we've got a bit of work to do to tidy that up. But we've got some very interesting feedback from schools that have chosen not to use textbooks. And schools that choose not to use textbooks, and there are some really interesting case studies of schools that have just decided we don't need textbooks. They have never reported the curriculum as being overcrowded. So, or, you know, as being superficial, or so they devise their own plans, they work with their own resources. So what they have found is that they have taken control of what happens in the journey from the curriculum in the box to the curriculum in the classroom. Whereas for many teachers, that control is given to the textbooks. And what they find they're racing to do is to cover the textbook as opposed to cover the curriculum. Now, I'm not saying that that's solely the blame, if you like, for the sense of there's an awful lot to do, because there is a lot to do. And when you have bigger classes and you have greater expectations, it can feel very busy. But I think that the research into the textbooks, I think we're only just beginning to see that perhaps sometimes there's the box of the curriculum, but there's also the piles of textbooks. And there's a sense in which one might sometimes displace the other.
And given that textbooks do have such an impact on how the curriculum is delivered in schools, or how it is mediated in schools, is that better?
Somewhat, yeah.
Do you not think that the NCCA could take a more proactive role in vetting the quality of textbooks?
This is an issue that's come up quite a lot in the last while, largely because we are so fond of textbooks here. And we're one of the few countries where the textbook market is unregulated, and where parents buy the textbooks for the most part, or hire them. In fact, I think from looking at the research, we're probably now the only country where you have an unregulated textbook market. In other words, anybody can produce a textbook. And the funding for textbooks is private. In other words, it's from families, unless they get some assistance or there's money for a book rental scheme. In most other countries where there's an unregulated market, the state buys the textbook, or there's a regulated market and the parents buy them. So we actually have both. So it's kind of, school textbook publishers, it's no wonder they publish editions every year. Now, it is interesting that the minister has asked them to look at this and maybe think about the need, whether or not there's a need to update editions of textbooks every year. So the minister's already asked them to look at the degree to which they change. Whether or not the NCCA should get involved in vetting them is a moot point. I think if you would like to give teachers access to lots of different resources from which they can make choices. Because remember, I said the teacher is the key professional. So you do want to ensure that they've got lots of choices of handbooks and materials to use. And I would have a concern that regulation of any kind might end up into sort of very narrowing. I have this vision of, you know, just a single textbook for everybody. And maybe there should be choices around resources. So I think we need to find a balance. I think the issue, we already give guidelines to publishers, and we say whether, you know, we say that in particular, for particular subject areas, the textbook needs to be A, B, C, D, E, or whatever it might be. And publishers are pretty good at following those, but some publishers are less good at following them. And whether or not we need to do more in saying whether or not particular textbooks follow the guidelines, I think that question is on the table at the moment. And the jury's out on it. I can see both sides.
And if we go back then, Anne, to some of the schools that have decided not to work with textbooks, doesn't that put an awful lot of extra work on teachers who then have to start designing instructional materials as well as doing the teaching?
You should talk to the teachers sometime, Sean, in the schools, because they have found is it's a different kind of work. They were already preparing plans. They were already doing their planning. So they're just sharing and collaborating around resources. And they've also found that perhaps they feel that the amount of teacher talk that has been going on in the classroom has been somewhat reduced and that students are a bit more engaged. It would be well worthwhile talking to some of the principals and teachers involved where they really have scaled back because they report it as a positive. They don't report it as extra work.
I'm just even thinking in my own area how hard it is to find good problems in maths and how, you know, if teachers, I mean, whatever about the problems in the current textbooks, which I would have difficulties with, at least there are problems there. Whereas to go looking for good problems yourself is quite a task, and then to teach them as well.
Yeah, but if you're looking for good problems yourself, you're probably on a high road to nothing. But if you're looking for good problems as a group of teachers, then you can share resources. I'm going to Cavan on Monday, where the post-primary school there, I should say that in general, it's primary schools we've encountered who've given up the textbooks. We have a long way to go in post-primary, but I'm going to Cavan on next week, where they're launching a new VLE where all of the post-primary teachers are sharing digital resources through a kind of a Moodle framework. And they're, in other words, so if a teacher has found, here's a really natty little maths problem that's really good to work through with students, they're sharing it. Which gives it access to 140 other teachers working in the vocational education scheme in Cavan. Now, that's an interesting development. And initially, one of the problems was teachers going, I'm not sharing my resources with anybody. I work long and hard to develop these. But actually, when they've seen and received the feedback from other teachers who said, that was amazing, it worked this way, have you seen this one? In other words, you develop a culture of collaboration. I think it's an interesting way to go.
What do you think personally has been your greatest achievement in your role here? What are you most proud of that you've done so far in the NCCA?
Can I mention two? Okay, the first would be that in the last 10 years ago, the NCCA didn't have any role in early childhood education. And when we took on that brief, we were quite rightly greeted with a lot of suspicion by the sector. It's not that they're a suspicious sector, but that they looked at us and said, we're a bunch of teachers. And we do curriculums and assessment and things that are not part of early childhood. 10 years on, Early Childhood Ireland, which is the new agency the Preschool Playgroups Association and the Children's Nurseries Association are amalgamating into a new agency, Early Childhood Ireland. 10 years on, they see the NCCA as a really significant partner. So we've worked really hard, Sarah and Arlene and the team here, I've worked really hard over the last decade to learn from the early childhood sector, to learn about how they've, you know, drawn on research and really integrated play into what they've done. We've offered them, we've worked with them to develop the ASHTER, the framework for early learning. And I think that was a very big, significant kind of move. And I think it's going to make a difference to how we approach working in primary schools. I'd also be particularly proud of how we've integrated research into our work. We really try and make it evidence-informed now. And we gather research, we commission research, we read research, we ask ourselves, what does research say about that? But we also encourage teachers to say, what does research say about that? And, you know, and to help teachers really use research in their own work. And I think that's been a very significant change for NCCA. And I'm particularly proud of the way we've managed to do that and lead in that field and become a really significant player in early childhood education and in educational research.
And that was the Chief Executive Officer of the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, Dr. Anne Looney. On next week's programme, Anne will share her views on assessment, junior cert reform, the Leaving Certificate, the CAO point system and transition year. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Thanks to our guest, Anne Looney, and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.